Welcome to the Versus History Podcast with your hosts, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, Connell Smith, and Elliot Watson.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Versus History. It's myself, Patrick O'Shaughnessy, at History Chappie on behalf of the editorial team. This week, we had the absolute pleasure of catching up with Professor Kehinde Andrews via Skype. Here it is.
Professor Kehinde Andrews at Birmingham City University. Thank you very much indeed for coming on Versus History today. We're very, very grateful.
No, thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. You're a huge name out in the academic world and beyond. You've written numerous books. I know from YouTube that you recently appeared or somewhat recently on one of the Breakfast Time TV shows in the UK discussing Winston Churchill with Piers Morgan. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
And you've been on numerous other podcasts as well with far bigger names than us. Russell Brand included.
They're all good conversations.
Of course. Okay then, Kehinde, I'll start with a curveball if I may. If we sent you to a desert island and you could only take one genre of music with you and one dish, one culinary delight, what would they be and why?
Oh, wow. One genre of music, that's got to be 90s hip-hop, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely, because I'm old. Yeah, oldish.
Same.
So I remember when hip-hop sounded good. Definitely 90s hip-hop. And a dish? I should probably say something Caribbean, but actually I'm going to say lamb ribs.
Okay.
Lamb ribs, they're just really good. So.
You've returned a curveball to the curveball. That's fantastic. Okay. In terms of you and your scholarship, if you had to sell yourself in 1 minute or explain to our listeners who you are and all the wonderful things you've done in the academic world or the black radical world, what would you say?
Oh, well, I mean, I think the main contribution is really to kind of outline what black radical politics looks like, because I think that, you know, we really need to rethink where we are and rethink where we're going. And I think that's the biggest contribution of my work, is to say, well, actually, revolution is possible if we do the right things.
Okay, you've recently written a book. I know because I've read it, and it's called Back to Black. What are the key themes of that book there for someone that hasn't read it and is maybe considering purchasing it?
So Back to Black really is about, it's about the argument that's saying that, you know, we had 50 years ago, we're at a moment where there was this kind of black revolution, Pan-Africanism and the African continent, you know, black power movement in America and in Britain. You even had like the Rastafari movement in the Caribbean. And it was like there was a moment where we really, capitalism wasn't necessarily going to continue. And when we talked about revolution then, and Malcolm X, my absolute favorite person in history, when Malcolm X was talking about revolution, it was a real thing. And over the last 50 years, what's happened is, in Africa, in the UK, in America, everywhere, we've essentially gone down the wrong road. We've started to believe that we can reform this system and get some kind of equality within it. And that's the biggest problem that we face today. So Back to Black really is saying that, no, we need to look back. We need to understand the mistakes we made politically in the past and build that revolutionary politics again.
So you've just mentioned Malcolm X there. I'm sure many of our students around the world will be familiar with him. You mention him a lot of times in your books and all the podcasts I've listened to you. How did he contribute to the black radical tradition?
So Malcolm really is my favourite because he articulates it the best. So one of the things that the book Back to Black does is it kind of picks out some of the things that we think of are black radicalism, but really are not. So, for example, black Marxism, some versions of black nationalism, in the Nation of Islam that Malcolm was a part of for a very long time. And so what Malcolm does, he's kind of a spokesman for black radicalism. And black radicalism has existed before Malcolm, it existed after Malcolm, but Malcolm kind of articulates it well. That's why we remember him, because he really makes the points.
You've mentioned the lost found Nation of Islam. You mentioned Malcolm X a lot, Professor Andrews. If I may be, it might sound a tad critical, you don't mention the Honourable Elijah Muhammad, as his followers would have called him, as much. But Malcolm spent for the majority of the time that he was in the public ether, he was under the tutelage and the aegis of the Nation of Islam, under Elijah Muhammad. What did Elijah Muhammad contribute?
Well, this is one of the things in the book I'm trying to put across, is that my main criticism of Malcolm probably would be that he spent far too much time in the Nation of Islam. I mean, he eventually leaves in 63, and for a number of circumstances. But if you actually look at Malcolm's politics, they diverge from the Nation much, much earlier on. And he was always going to leave eventually. Because the Nation does some good things, but it fundamentally is a reactionary, not revolutionary organization.
Okay.
And if you look at the contribution of Elijah Muhammad, as really is not in the book that much, is because effectively that politics don't work. There's a reason Malcolm leaves, because he understands the nation is just far too narrow and far too limited.
Okay, when Malcolm does leave the Lost Found Nation of Islam, he goes on to set up two of his own organisations. One is secular and political, one is religious. The religious one is Muslim Mosque Incorporated. I think it's maybe fair to say that's another black Muslim organisation. But the Organisation of Afro-American Unity, I know he was only out of the nation for 1 year. How would you critique or how would you analyse or evaluate those organisations, considering that chronologically they were only around for 1 year while Malcolm was alive? What did they actually achieve?
Yeah, so I mean, this is where I don't think we can blame Malcolm for this because Malcolm died. But if the followers of Malcolm, actually, one of the things I wanted to do, so I am going to write a book, The Social Theory of Malcolm X, because I think that Malcolm is one of the most misunderstood political thinkers, intellectuals. Malcolm leaves a very, very, very clear legacy, because everybody just basically ignores it, right? So he becomes a devout Sunni Muslim, and that's where he starts the Muslim Mosque Incorporated.
Yeah.
But he also says that that's very, very separate from his politics. That's one of the problems of the nation. It conflated the religion and the politics. Like, to be a Muslim was to be saved. And Malcolm's saying that's not true at all. Like, he's a Muslim and that's important to him. But in order for us to have freedom, we have to have a black organization, a global black organization, which is secular, effectively, which can bring all of us together. And the idea behind the OAAU, Organization for American Unity, was sound. I mean, it built on the Garvey movement. The idea was to have different chapters. It essentially created a government for black people where we dealt with education, security, etc., funded by black people. Like, the organization had quite a high membership fee. It's a bit like tax, right? And that is the revolutionary vehicle. We've set up the organization, Harambe Organization of Black Unity in Birmingham in the UK based on that vision. Problem is, Malcolm gets killed and the idea falls apart and everybody then picks out what they think Malcolm meant to them, but actually ignores the organization, which has a very clear goal and program.
Thank you, Professor. Chronologically, maybe reversing, maybe 40 years from Malcolm's assassination, what were the contributions of Marcus Garvey and Du Bois to the civil rights movement or the emerging sort of black nationalist movement?
So Garvey's really important. So Malcolm's basic philosophy is Garveyism. If you really look at it, if you look at the Nation of Islam pick up a lot of the Garvey economic model and self-reliance. So the Garvey movement, and we often associate Garvey with Marcus Garvey, but Amy Jakes Garvey and Amy Ashwin Garvey, his two wives, were really also massively influential in the Garvey movement, particularly Amy Jakes Garvey, who curates the books afterwards. So we know most of the things we know about the Garvey movement are from Amy Jakes's collection, The Philosophy and Opinions of Marcus Garvey, and the book Garvey and Garveyism. And the Garvey movement is the biggest black movement that's ever existed, 5 million members across 50 plus countries 100 years ago, and really is a model of black organization. This is essentially what Malcolm's trying to start with the OAAU, with some more radical politics, because Garveyism economically is basically black capitalism, which is problematic. And that's another problem with the Nation of Islam. And you mentioned Du Bois. I mean, Du Bois is interesting because Garvey and Du Bois hated, like, they had a proper rivalry.
Yeah.
Mostly sparked by Du Bois, because actually Garvey was a Du Bois fan. I mentioned this in the book. He was in the delegation in 1915 when Du Bois went to Jamaica and Garvey was there to greet him. Garvey looked up to Du Bois, but when he went to Harlem, Du Bois basically just totally rejected it, called him stupid, ugly, and black. Du Bois was really quite elitist. I mean, Du Bois really was like a Negro intellectual at this point, quite elitist, didn't want to see the foreign, uneducated Garvey and all his movements. And so Du Bois is important, but Du Bois has a kind of more elite vision of the politics. Even if you look at Du Bois' Pan-Africanism, it's kind of more this elite nation, head of state vision. Whereas if you look at the Garvey movement is about the grassroots, millions of members coming together to do something very, very different.
Okay. Obviously in schools, when the civil rights movement is taught, sometimes it's taught as there's a sort of virtual battle between peaceful protest in the United States of America versus militant protest. Is there any value to that approach, or is it fundamentally flawed? Do we need to readjust the paradigm of our pedagogical approach when we're teaching about the civil rights movement?
Well, I mean, yeah, the idea that about it basically comes down to violence or non-violence. But this really was not the debate, right? People like Malcolm and the Black Panther Party, they were arguing that non-violence doesn't make sense, but they were not arguing that violence is what you need. In fact, they were usually arguing for self-defense. if someone's violent to you, you should defend yourself. What did Malcolm say? Someone puts a hand on me, I'll send him to the cemetery. But no one's, there wasn't an argument here for let's go pick up the gun and have a violent revolution, because America's America. That's not really a practical, it's not really a practical solution. The real difference between civil rights, black radicalism, is how do we diagnose the system? So the Martin Luther King approach, the civil rights approach, was that this, all the racism that we see and still see is an example that the system is broken, doesn't work properly. And if you can just get black people access to it, if you can get the right reforms, then that system will eventually work and we can all have equality. On the other hand, the radicals are saying, that's not really true. All these inequalities that we see are a product of the system. It's the logic of the system. It's what the system does. So when Malcolm says, the system can no more provide freedom and justice and equality for black people than a chicken can lay a duck egg.
Yes.
That's what he means, right? Like, that's the point. So, and this is what you have to have revolution. There's no, you can change any laws you want to change, it's still going to be the same. And 50 years after the quite successful civil rights movement, right? They get voting rights, they get desegregation, we got black elected officials, get a black president, but still the problems are exactly the same as they were. And in some ways, they're worse now than they were then. So that's really the defining line, revolution or reform, between civil rights and black radicalism.
The conversation logically moves on to Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King. What's your interpretation, sir?
Hey, look, King and more generally the civil rights movement. So I think we probably give King too much credit. Like, people like Ella Baker is probably the most, probably the most influential civil rights movement activist is Ella Baker, who's in like all of the civil rights movement, big major movements, so major organizations at some point. But if you take King as a stand-in for civil rights, like I said, the movement was successful. It got what they wanted. It was a huge mobilization of people, mobilized the levers of power. Even Malcolm says he respected Martin Luther King. Problem was just wrong. Like, it just didn't have the correct analysis. What are we, I mean, even King says it at some point, like he's at the end, he's worried that he's integrated his people into a burning house. Yes, he wasn't talking about racism. He was talking about more about Vietnam at that point. But that's the problem. That's all, you integrate black people into a system which is racist, the outcome is always going to be more racism. I actually think King would have seen this. I actually think King was probably, if anything, King's moving to more towards Malcolm, more towards radicalism. So I don't think the version of King we get where he's all post-racial and that one line of the speech where they say, I want my kids to be judged by the color of the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I mean, that isn't really King, so that's a whitewashed version of King. I actually imagine King may have become a radical if he was alive today.
Obviously, Malcolm X didn't see the Black Panthers form because he'd been assassinated by them. What's your interpretation? What's your view or analysis on the Black Panthers? Did they achieve anything?
The Panthers are a really important movement. But again, I think this is one of those areas where, you know, the Panthers like to think of themselves as the children of Malcolm. But again, Malcolm started the organization Afro-American Unity, which had a constitution and a very clear platform that the Panthers didn't embrace. So the Panthers were more Marxist in their orientation. They were still black. They weren't like communist. It's very important. They started a separate black organization. But their analysis was still largely Marxist. And they didn't fully, they didn't fully engage in that program that Malcolm left behind. However, they are a really important organization. Did some really important theorizing around the police, the role of politics. The idea of survival pending revolution. So like, you need to create, we want to have a revolution, but we also need to look after people here. I mean, I think that's really important as well. The Panthers didn't last for very long, but their influence is huge. And you can still see their influence today. Iconography, the propaganda of the Panthers. So the Panthers are really, really important.
So far, the conversation's been quite sort of America, US-centric. What was the parallel in the United Kingdom? Were there any similar movements? Was there any correlation between America and Britain? Or was it a completely different ether, a completely separate domain?
No, so I think, I mean, one of the things in American politics is we forget that Black America isn't really exist. So Black America has massive influences of the parts. So, for example, the Garvey movement, which is the biggest black movement in America in terms of numerically, where's Garvey from? Garvey's Jamaican, right? But that's actually a Jamaican-inspired started movement. And given that up until, I mean, certainly after the... So black people start moving to the United Kingdom later you know, post-war 60s, and the Jamaican immigration is a big part of that. My family's Jamaican immigrants. Garvey was hugely important. Garvey, in fact, the big difference in America and Britain is that Garvey is the basis of probably most of our political movements, certainly the more radical ones in the UK. Things like Rastafari as well have been really big in the UK. And they've been, like, Rastafari is in America, but it's not as big. In the UK, Rastafari is huge, particularly with younger people in the 70s and the 80s. But then also, you know, the messages of the Panthers. You know, there's a British Black Panther Party inspired by the American Black Panther Party. Malcolm X is just the biggest figure, and Martin Luther King is just the bigger figure here as they were in America. So there's been a lot of crossover between the American situation, but there's also been, I guess, a more British aesthetic as well. But I think the big thing is that Britain, you know, in terms of Britain on these islands, there have not been that many of us here for that long. So you tend to find that the roots of our politics are either Caribbean, Africa as well, really important, and America.
We hope that you are enjoying this episode of the Versus History podcast. Versus History are proud to have published a range of history books, all of which are available via Amazon. Our titles include the highly popular and best-selling 33 Ways to Improve Your History Essays, Blowing Up the Nazis, and University History Essays and How to Write Them, and many others. For more information, please visit our Amazon author page or versushistory.com.
I'm going to hit you with another curveball. You've mentioned migration there. And I suppose, now I'm making a big presumption here, for many people in Britain, maybe the modern narrative, when they're thinking of migration, they're thinking of migration coming into Britain. However, until the sort of 1980s, Britain was a net exporter of people. If you just look at a map, you look at New Zealand, Australia, America, Canada, South Africa, and many other places. How would you like history teachers like me to teach about colonialism?
Well, I think the first thing is to teach Britain as an empire, right? So this migration, both from places like Africa, Caribbean, India to Britain, the British Isles, and also the out-migration of white people to these settler colonies, like Australia, South Africa, etc. That's internal migration. I mean, we think of that as being like migration to foreign countries. And even like post-60s when you have formal independence, really, these are not foreign places. These are all places within the British Empire. And until very relatively recently, 60s, 70s, in some cases it's still the case, these are part of the British national state. So when we take people moving around, they're just moving around Britain, right? So my dad's first passport when he came to the UK, it's a British passport. It's a Jamaican one. Right, so this isn't foreigners, this is people moving within the empire. And the same with white people moving within different parts of the empire as well. And if we started to understand that, this internal migration, that kind of changes how we see everything, completely changes all of this debate about Windrush and migration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And also changes how we see these other parts of the world. So somewhere like South Africa, Australia as well. They're all just empire.
Okay, moving on. You wrote an article recently for The Guardian. I've got a question here from my co-editor. He would like me to ask you about cultural appropriation in museums. Where do you stand on things like the Elgin Marbles being in the British Museum? Can modern nations own the past treasures of others?
No, they're stolen goods. You should return stolen goods, right? But that's a basic principle of the law. You steal something, you give it back. And these goods were literally just stolen out of various countries. There really is no justification whatsoever for keeping them. The only justification that the museum world really give is that there isn't the right conditions, if you like, in Nigeria, for example, to return the Benin bronzes. They wouldn't be looked after properly. But A, that's a bit of a patronizing European way of looking at things. And B, if that is the case, well, then send some money over, train some people and make sure they can have their own stuff. But if you look at, like, there is no real, I can't see a proper argument that says that Britain should keep hold of things they stole from other countries.
Slightly different tack. Slavery in the British Empire, looking at the abolition of the slave trade, 1807, and then the abolition of slavery, 1833. What do you see as the biggest drivers or causal factors towards Britain abandoning the slave trade? So if a teacher's out there and they want to teach it better, what would your interpretation on the sort of hierarchy of causal factors be?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing would be to stop teaching abolition as though that is Britain's involvement in slavery, which is generally how Britain is seen. Because of the way the empire worked, you know, Britain's slave plantations were in the Caribbean. And I've heard it referenced so many times, this idea that West Indian slavery. And you have this idea that Britain ended West Indian slavery as though it wasn't British people enslaving people in the West Indies or in the Caribbean. And so just decentering abolition would be the first thing. Actually, let's understand how deeply involved Britain was in the trade. I mean, Britain was, at the end of the last two centuries, the biggest slave trader. Then, if you want to talk about abolition, we really need to not talk about it as this moral force, the Wilberforce, as it's been called, because that's really not how it, why it ends. I mean, the slave trade is not abolished because of the morality of it in the British Empire. It's abolished for a number of reasons, primarily economic reasons and fears of resistance. So 1807, the trade is abolished, although slavery continues for almost, well, actually does actually basically continue effectively for 30 years afterwards. And it's not a coincidence that in 1804, Haiti has the only successful slave rebellion in history.
Of course, yes.
Because they're essentially terrified. I mean, they're essentially terrified. What happens in Haiti? Haiti is a example where, actually, Haiti tells you the whole story of why Britain abolished the slave trade in 1807. So Haiti is the most prosperous sugar plantation island on when at the time the revolution happens. And it was also one of the harshest slave systems. So you essentially worked to death on Haiti, and they just replaced you. People didn't have children in Haiti. They just worked you to death and replaced you with somebody else, right? Now, this meant that about 60% of all the enslaved in Haiti, 60 to two-thirds, were African-born. Like, they were born free in Africa, and they're placed on the island. And this is one of the reasons why the revolution happened, right? Because people they're born free. Also, at the time, there's a civil war in the Congo, and so a lot of the enslaved who have been taken to France are actually warriors who've been caught up in this war. So you've got people who are free, who have no business, who are no business in slavery, and have the ability to fight. And they're the people who really push the revolution forward. So the logic becomes, when this revolution's successful, well, let's stop getting Africans. Africans are the problem. If we can breed our own slaves, they'll be far more docile. So we don't need any more of these dangerous Africans. And then the second reason you see in France why Britain's really, really keen to end the trade and not slavery in 1807 is because we often think about Britain and France being competitors and they don't get on. But actually, globalization and this system of the West cooperating has been in existence for hundreds of years. And half of all the enslaved and British on our French slave plantations were actually taken there by British ships, right? So Britain's key competitor, France, can only maintain its most successful colony, which is apparently competing with Britain, because of British ships. And it's actually William Pitt, the Prime Minister at the time, who sees this in the late 18th century and says, "This is madness. Why are we propping up French slavery?" And yes, he's the one then that tells Wilberforce, says, "Hey, Wilberforce, you should get involved in this abolition thing. We need to stop this trade and stop supporting our competitor." Because Britain had basically had enough of the enslaved, and France didn't. So there's economic reasons which end this trade. It really has nothing to do with morality at all.
Thank you, Professor Andrews. A completely different tack again. How has the recent rise in populist politics affected your approach to the teaching and learning of black studies?
I hasn't really. I guess I just carry on in it. How would it affect the approach?
That's a very, very good counter question. I suppose, well, this is a curveball again. I've taken this question from JS4 in Hong Kong. I'm guessing that the populist politics have risen in recent years. Has that had any bearing whatsoever on how you approach the teaching and learning of your subject at university level?
No, I mean, I think one of the key things about Black Studies is that Black Studies, we brought Black Studies into the university, but it is not a university-inspired topic. It's a topic which has been taught in communities in the UK for decades, more broadly for centuries. And it's a topic which we teach the things that we need to teach, right? Like, there's radical elements in there, there's black feminism in there, there's community engagement and stuff in there. But it doesn't really change on the winds of European ideas. Yeah. Like, we just do what needs to be done. So the populism has no effect, negative or positive.
Okay, I'm sure you're pleased to hear I'm nearing the end of the questions, Professor Andrews. You've talked about black sports stars taking a knee during the national anthem in the United States. What's your perspective on that, saying things like the NFL? Was it right to do that? What's your opinion?
I mean, of course. I mean, the American national anthem is an affront to all black people, I would suggest. I think there's my only question, that I think to flip that would be, is it enough? I mean, if you look at the way that sports work, and if you look at the way that sports particularly oppress, I mean, they're so exploitative of black people in America more generally, is taking a knee during the national anthem enough, right? That's just a quite a mild protest in some ways. But it should also be recognized. It's some one of the things I always look at America is the situation in America tells you just how dire things are in the UK. Because I can't even imagine, I literally cannot imagine a black sports star kneeling during the national anthem. I mean, can you imagine Raheem Sterling kneeling during the national anthem? No. The whole world would explode. Their country would explode. So at least in America, they're being vocal about something and they're protesting. Whereas in the UK, sports stars, honestly, are black sports stars, I think, have let us down a lot because we don't have. I really can't think of any example like the Black Power salute in the 68 or the Kaepernick with the taking the knee. I mean, I guess John Barnes has come out and has started talking about white supremacy, but it's a stark contrast, I think, to what's happening in the UK. And also, I think one of that things is that what we don't tend to understand is racism's in some ways more insidious here than it is in America. Because we can see things quite openly in America. People get gunned down by the police, people protest. But actually, in some ways, it's worse here. Because the same basic things happen, but we don't protest. And particularly in the area of sports, you can see that it's just totally silenced. And the sports stars just don't have the space to do that.
I know from your podcast with BBC History Extra, you said Black History Month is better than nothing. Let's say there's a teacher out there who wants to celebrate Black History. What would you suggest they do, or what should their aims and objectives be? How can they do Black History Month better, or how can they help teach and learn about Black History better, in your view?
Well, the main thing you really want to do is you want to incorporate Black History into history. Right, I mean, I never forget being in A-level history. I did A-level history and did Industrial Revolution. And I went to the teacher and I was like, it seems like slavery should be important here because it happened at the same time. And his actual response to me was, look, it's not in the textbook, so let's not talk about it, right? And there's a way that we teach history which just totally is, one, incorrect, and two, totally excludes histories of the rest of the world. This is why we're saying, like, Black History Month is better than nothing, but it's extraordinarily tokenistic. And actually what you want to teach is just teach history properly. And if you teach history properly, you realize there's black people, Asian people, everybody's in it and really has always been part of what Britain is. But you've got this version of schools that comes out of the school curriculum, which, you know, British history is this white history that doesn't include any of us, which is a totally wrong way to think about it.
Okay, to change tack again, it's a personal question. I'm guessing that you grew up in Birmingham, in United Kingdom. Who were your mentors and inspirations growing up?
Parents, mum and dad. Mum worked for the Commission for Racial Equality for decades. My dad was part of the Harambe organization, founded the Harambe organization, was part of the African Caribbean Self-Help organization. So I just grew up with that activist family. And then also, I think books. Like, I got my inspiration for books. Malcolm, Claudia Jones, Angela Davis, Sartre Shakur. I think those are my role models, I think, and especially at teenage years.
A question, it might be a tad controversial. If anyone wants to listen to rap music over the last sort of 20 years, they might hear the mention of the current leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, or they might hear reference to the Five Percenters. And many rappers have talked openly about their respect for the work of Louis Farrakhan in Chicago and beyond. What's your perspective? Because obviously it's not mentioned so much out of the sort of rap music, hip-hop domain. I know Farrakhan's work's been credited with, you know, helping to end the sort of East Coast, West Coast feud. What's your opinion there?
Yeah, I'll make it plain as I can, man. You cannot support Malcolm X and support Louis Farrakhan. Yeah, but that's simple. I mean, look, Malcolm leaves the Nation for a reason and then is killed by members of the Nation of Islam. And more than likely, Louis Farrakhan was directly involved, but certainly knew about it and condoned it, right? So, and I think this is what really, and I guess partly what the book is about, is about, we kind of have this weak black nationalism where because black people do something good, like Farrakhan give a good speech occasionally, or maybe he'll do something relatively positive, we just kind of forget everything else. And we kind of lump everybody in together as though they're all positive. Farrakhan is not positive. The Nation of Islam is not a positive influence. And I think we have to start being very clear about this and separating these things out, right? So, yeah, I have no love at all for Farrakhan.
Yeah, you made that very, very clear. Thank you very much, Professor Andrews. Is there anything else that my limited parochial questions didn't give you the opportunity to speak about that you'd want students around the world to know about Black studies and Black contributions to history? So is there anything that basically I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, I think just the key messages, and so my work is Black studies and the book is Black Revolution, but that message of Black Revolution is a message for it's a message for everybody. It's a message to say that, look, this system isn't broken. It works perfectly fine. And we're never going to have equality here. You're going to have equality in Asia, in Africa, in the Caribbean, Latin America, until we have a new political and economic system. And the legacy history and future of Black radical politics is really telling us that revolution is possible. And this is what we need to think about. We need to completely reimagine where we're going, because we need to completely reimagine the political and economic system.
I don't think there's any better way to end than that, sir. Thank you very much indeed, Professor Kehinde Andrews.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Versus History podcast. Visit us at www.versushistory.com and follow us at Versus History on Twitter and Instagram. You can download all episodes from iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or from wherever you get your podcasts.